Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today we're talking again to Professor James McManus, one of the top poker writers out there. We'll be talking about his most famous book, Positively Fifth Street. Jim McManus, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
I'm happy to be back, guys.
We're happy to have you. Now, the book deals with you getting a $4,000 advance from Harper's Magazine to fly from your home in Chicago to Las Vegas in the year 2000 to cover the women in the World Series of Poker main event and also to cover the trial of Sandy Murphy and Rick Tavish, who were accused of killing Ted Binion and later on robbing him. Sounds like a nice gig. At the time, how important was $4,000 to your family?
The context is that my third and fourth children had recently been born, and we had a mortgage that we were in a little bit deep on, and there was a real legitimate question raised by my wife Jennifer as to whether I should be spending that money, especially since I had, you know, the expense money was going to be due to me for sure, but I had yet to report on and write the article, so that I was gambling with money that I hadn't earned yet, and so it was a dicey, ticklish situation. I got lucky that I won some money instead of losing it.
Uh-huh. Did that help in future gambling endeavors?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if it was the first tournament that I had ever entered, and it was the main event of the World Series, and that I finished fifth, it gave me a sense that I was a better poker player than I actually was. It took me a few years to appreciate how lucky I had to get in order to finish fifth out of 512 players. At the time, when I got knocked out in fifth place, Hassan Habib beat me with a worse hand. I felt that I had been tremendously unlucky, but overall, I got very lucky to win that satellite and also to advance as far as I did.
Speaking of the
Go ahead, Bob.
Speaking of the satellite, you decided to try to earn your way into the main event and trying to win a 10-person, $1,015 satellite, the winner of which gets $10,000 entry fee.
That's
how
right.
How much poker experience did you have before coming to Vegas?
I had 40 years of low-stakes experience against family members first. My high school friend, my friends in grammar school and high school played a little bit higher stakes in college. And then I had been out to Vegas and played some limit poker at the Bellagio. The highest I had played was 8160, which is a sizable game. But I had never been in I didn't understand tournament structure nearly as well as I needed to. However, I had practiced a lot using Bob Wilson's software, which you could play no-money tournaments online. And so I was able, in the 4 months between I got the assignment and when I left to cover the event, to get some not real life practice, but by reading books and playing on well-designed software, I did have probably a better than average sense of how to play tournament poker.
Now, you won this satellite, and it only cost $1,015, but somehow you lost your whole bankroll doing this. How did that happen?
Well, when we got down to three players, a deal was reached in which I paid the people who were the final three. We were fairly close in chips. I had a few more chips than they did, and I ended up paying them about $1,200 or $1,300 apiece to we made a deal that the winner would pay the people who didn't win $1,200 or $1,300. So it ended up costing me my $1,000 buy-in and then another $2,500 or so.
Okay. So which is basically all the money you had.
Yes.
So you had some days to kill before the tournament, some players to interview, and somehow you got to get yourself ready for the main event. What'd you do?
Well, don't forget the part where I had to go to the strip clubs and research the environment in which Ted Binion had met Sandy Murphy, the woman who had allegedly murdered him. So
Trust me, we're going to talk about that and what your wife thought about that cockamamie excuse. But go ahead.
Well, I had to report on what was going on in the courthouse, research the strip club vibe, and also interview players, female players, because at that point I didn't know that the article was going to end up being more about me, my own action, than I was very interested in talking to people like Annie Duke, Jennifer Harmon, and a few other women, Linda Johnson, women who had won World Series of poker gold bracelets.
So, since you so rudely brought it up, let's talk about cheetahs. This is the strip club. You know going in that if it makes the article and your wife reads it, she's not going to be happy about that. So, how did that put a damper on looking at all the silicone-infested boobs?
Well, it wasn't cheetahs. It was spearmint rhino. Cheetahs is in Vegas, the strip clubs are more or less divided between the all-nude clubs in which you cannot buy alcohol and the much more popular clubs in which the women wear G-strings and you can buy alcohol. Those attract a different, more upscale crowd and performers. So cheetahs was something that I didn't really want to spend too much. It was a place I didn't want to spend too much time in. Meanwhile, as I'm doing the research, I know that I'm going to write this in the article. I didn't know that I had a book yet, and I did know that my wife would not have approved. At the same time, it didn't seem like such a terrible thing to have gotten a few lap dances, since the book wouldn't be as authentic. Now I'm using quotation marks. If I had experienced some of those some of the dances that Ted had experienced in person. Obviously, I'm joking.
Did you have to experience the heroin and cocaine too to get that part of the story?
I didn't have to become a heroin addict. But I did think that since I was interested in checking out that scene, that tagging it with the word research would help legitimize it at least somewhat in my beloved Jennifer's mind and heart.
Uh-huh.
And how did she handle all of it?
Well, she had two things that she had to handle. She had to handle the fact that I had gone to the strip club, which was not an epically terrible thing. It certainly wasn't grounds for divorce, in her opinion. But the tougher part for her was that it was out in public in the book form, and then the book became a bestseller. And, you know, many of her friends and our children's parents were interested in talking to her about that. And it did make for a series of extremely awkward conversations. And it was not her least favorite aspect of having her husband do well in the tournament and write a best-selling book about it.
It was not her least favorite.
Yep. It was not her favorite aspect.
Yeah, I bet
it wasn't. You know, the book got us into a different house. and it changed our life pretty dramatically. But that aspect of it was kind of a drag for her. But we're still together. She's forgiven me, and everything's copacetic.
Well, that's great to hear. But at the time that it was going on, was that a bigger deal, or was it that you had spent $4,000 getting into the tournament?
Yeah, I mean, that was given the fact that we had two very young children at home, and our mortgage was a little bit steeper than we were able to comfortably handle. It was a big deal. Since the outcome was so lucrative in terms of prize money and then the book deal, we both tend to forget that interim period between the time that I got the money advanced to me and the time that it was gone, and I, you know, the satellite didn't guarantee me of anything. The fact, you know, I had to wait three and a half, four days until I had the prize money, and at which point the risk had come through and my gamble had been redeemed. We did have a few debates on the subject of whether she eventually signed off on it, but my position was, I took a fairly strong position about this. I had been heard about the World Series of Poker in the 70s, back when I was in my early 20s. And since Al Alvarez's book about the World Series came out, that being the biggest game in town, came out in 1983, I was pretty determined to someday play in that event. And I thought that the assignment from Harper's was my best shot at it. And even though the editor, Lewis Lapham, didn't fully appreciate this, I was determined to play in that tournament. If I could, I mean, I didn't have anything resembling 10K in order to buy into a professional poker tournament. But I was, since I had the opportunity to play a satellite, and I've managed to win the first one I played, I got very lucky. But there was a four-day period in which the risk did not seem like it would have been the best way to spend that money.
Well, today there are like several $1,000 no limit events or $2,500 no limit events.
Mm-hmm.
Were those available back then at the time you
got
there?
Yes, there were.
Or it was,
yes, there were smaller tournaments. But the whole focus, my introduction to the World Series was Alvarez's book and then Tony Holden's book, Big Deal, which came out in the early 1990s. And all the focus of those, most of the focus of those books and the focus of the poker, of the general press's attitude about the World Series of Poker was all in the main event. So while I could have afforded to play a $1,500 or $2,000 event, since the article was going to be about the main event, that was the event that I wanted to play in. And the majority of people who want to play in the World Series want to play in the main event. And that's why it gets so many more entries than all the other ones.
Okay. So other than spending an afternoon at a strip club, you still had some time to kill before the main event. What did you do to get ready?
I couldn't. My computer at the time didn't allow me to continue practicing with Bob Wilson's software, but I was able to. I read T.J. Cloutier's book. I read Doyle Brunson's. I read Super System. I read David Sklansky, although Sklansky's emphasis is on limit hold'em. His theory of poker gives you a superior. Is a deep dive into the theory of what kinds of bets work in particular situations. So I studied up as much as I could. I was, as I refer to myself in the book, I was book learned. Most of the players in the event were learned how to play by playing high, building up from lower to higher stakes. I sort of jumped into the deep end of the pool with my sense of the game coming from advice from experts who had done well in it. Tom McAvoy, Cloutier, and Brunson, and people like that.
You were able to talk to quite a few people, which I found amazing. You mentioned several ladies, but including, Kathy Liebert and Katie Litterer,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
a bunch of the guys, too, pretty famous players, were all willing to talk to you. And I'm assuming basically none of them had heard of you before you got out there.
I didn't find it that surprising because there weren't that many reporters back then. Today, the tournament is teeming with reporters. There are hundreds of reporters out there for the main event now that it's played at the Rio. But back then, it would all fit in one room. The previous number of entrants had been 375 or 380, something like that, jumps to 512. But we're all in the tiny little horseshoe in Glitter Gulch. Downtown Las Vegas is a really small community. And everybody in the horseshoe knew that I was writing about it for the magazine. And, I got to meet Becky Bannon and her husband. It was not easy. Nolan Dalla introduced me around Linda Johnson. So I got a sufficient number of introductions to people. And people generally were willing to talk to a reporter.
One of the reporters back then was Andy Glaser.
Yeah.
I remember being very much a fan of his tournament synopsis that appeared in Card Player magazine.
Yeah.
Now, Andy died much too young. What do you remember about him?
Well, Andy was probably the most helpful. He took me under his wing. And he was an amazing guy. He had trained as an attorney, but he never really he graduated from law school. He passed the bar in Atlanta, and he never felt a calling to practice law. He wanted to be a poker player, and he wanted to write about the game. And he would produce. I mean, he was my main inspiration. Because he would sit there at the final table and hand after hand write a report on every hand that included witty asides and wonderful prose, precision reporting on who played what card, who played this hand in this position, and then he would go upstairs to a room in the Mint and produce a wonderfully evocative, funny, accurate account of final tables, some of which lasted 7 or 8 hours. 2-3 hours later, they would be up online, and people were able to read them. And he was definitely the blazing pioneer of poker tournament coverage. And he was also a warm, wonderful dude.
Yeah, he was a great guy. He was originally a backgammon player before he got into poker, so that's where I knew him from. But, I thought he was a good, really good writer and really captured those years when he was writing about the World Series really well. It was a shame when he died.
What really blew me away about his writing was not only was the quality of the prose excellent, and he got all the details right, and it was funny, but he did it so fast. If writers who are talented, if you give them 6 months or a year, they can produce a wonderful essay or memoir. If you give them 3 or 4 years, they can write a book. He was producing these 5,000, 8,000 word accounts 2 hours after the final table ended. That was what truly amazed me, because I had written for magazines, but I my deadlines would be 5 or 6 weeks after I had reported the material. He was producing it under 3 hours. So I was continually astonished by and impressed by that. He taught me a lot about how to write about poker.
Most interesting to me in the book was the play-by-play of perhaps 24 hands, most of which you were in, but some of which you weren't. To give a flavor for these hands, there was one against Annie Duke where you meant to raise her more than you were actually able to. What happened on this hand?
Apparently, I made a string raise. This was, again, this being my first tournament, I was making a lot of rookie mistakes. And the fact that I made such a small raise priced her into the pot, and she ended up calling. And she was very unhappy about it, and she was complaining. But by the time the hand was over, it turned out that she had a better hand than I did. She won the pot, and she reversed herself very quickly, saying that she was happy that she had been priced in.
Yeah, Annie was barefoot and pregnant during that tournament, as I recall. So the fact that her emotions weren't entirely under control is perhaps forgivable.
Yeah, and understandable, for sure. But she's also not a person to suffer frustrations quietly. So she was, she stood out in a variety of ways. With most of the players in the tournament were men. Here she's a young woman. She's pregnant. She's barefoot, but she's playing a high caliber of poker, and she wears her emotions on her sleeve and vocalizes them. Loudly.
Okay.
Yeah, that hasn't changed.
No.
Yeah, she's not barefoot and pregnant at the moment, but she's still known as the Ice Queen, I guess. There was another hand where you, Chris Ferguson, and Hassan Habib were contesting a pot, where you started with a pair of jacks, opened it, and after the flop came out, Ace Queen 2, and Chris Ferguson made a pretty big bet. And you were taking your time to think about it. Meanwhile, Hassan Habib, who was still in the hand, went to the rail. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't notice at the time that he was having a conversation with Tony Ma, which is one of the limit events that summer. And obviously a world-class player. And he and Tony had been friends for a while, having played in L.A. And they would or would not have a conversation is not something that I would have. My inexperience was such that I wouldn't have known that what was appropriate or what wasn't appropriate, because I had never played in a tournament. I had never played poker surrounded by dozens and dozens of people, reporters, spectators, and so on. Turned out that they were having a conversation that some people, including Nolan Dalla, thought was a little bit out of line. I believe I ended up folding the jacks to Cruz's bet, and then Hassan was not penalized. Hassan being the guy who basically knocked me out of the tournament on Thursday afternoon. And he and I have since become pretty good friends. In any case, Nolan wound up apologizing for writing about it, but it was an argument that was going on outside of my awareness.
So Andy Glaser called a hand with TJ Cloutier the hand of the tournament. So can you tell us about that?
Well, the background is that one of the books that I had studied the most closely was TJ's book about how to play Nolan and Hold'em tournaments, and which he co-wrote with Tom McAvoy. And he gives very tight, aggressive advice that you're not entering pots with big hand with drawing hands. You're entering pots with strong. You're not calling raises with anything smaller than the size of a pair, ace king or ace queen. And when you're playing ace king, if you do call the opening raise, you have to play the hand very aggressively. And I had, in the hand against him, he had ace nine and I had ace king. And the board came eight high and he attacked. And I was, you know, I was playing against this former CFL football player who played both offense and defense for the Montreal Alouettes. Big, scary looking dude. And one of the top tournament players in the world at that point, if not the winningest player. And I was a little bit intimidated by it, but I knew that was the case, and I decided to overcompensate by not being scared. You know, he put me to the test when I had nothing but top no pair. All I had was ace king, and he tried to put me all in on the turn, and with only ace king, having remembered how aggressively he advised people to play it, I ended up calling his raise. He turns over ace nine, and he didn't get saved on the river, and I ended up winning a massive pot, and I was late on the third night of a four-day tournament. I was the chip leader of the tournament. And it was a little bit of a crazy, scared call. But at the time, Emerald Slim said that I had the heart of a cliff diver. I'd like to think that was true. I was a bit confused by what was TJ's line of betting. But it turned out that I did make the right decision, and that was certainly the high point of my tournament.
Did you talk to TJ afterwards about the hand?
Yeah, I've talked to him about it over the years, and you know Slim had said that I had the heart of a cliff diver. TJ begged to differ. He said that I was a deer in the headlights, and he wasn't wrong when he said that. It was you know the toughest situation I had ever been in. I was a combination of scared and brave, and often the best calls are, that's an accurate description of the best calls. You make a crazy, stupid, scared, brave hero call, and that's what I did. And, you know, TJ's had a lot vastly more experience than I had at that point, and I tend to agree with him about the nature of my call.
Do you consider that more luck today or more skill?
I don't know that I can make, you know, I have so much more experience now. I've been playing tournaments for 17 years now, so I must be a better player. But I don't know that I can make that call now. I may have shoved, when he raised me, I may have re-raised him. I think I just called his raise pre-flop. The hand almost certainly would not have gone down the same way late in a tournament. I probably would have played ace-king much more aggressively before the flop. I probably would have three-bet him or even shoved on him, gone all in.
So you made the final table, which back then was six people instead of nine, which was, you know, an incredible accomplishment for an amateur player.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you, one more player got knocked out, so you were down to final five. And you got knocked out by Hassan Habib. Can you tell us about that hand? Do you remember that hand?
I wasn't knocked out by him. I was crippled by him. I had about 1.1 million, and he had about 900,000. And I was in the small blind, and he was on the button, and he shoves. And I knew that he was playing very aggressively, and I had an ace-queen. And my read was that I had a better hand was accurate. And the board rolls out, and I'm way ahead until the river card was a four. And I went from 1.1 million down to 200,000. At that point, I was on fumes. So that was the key hand for me. I lost the next hand. Ace Queen beat my Ace Deuce. Steve Kaufman knocked me out, but the hand that really killed me was the Hassan hand, in which I made the right decision.
Do you still have nightmares about that hand?
Well, Hassan bought a house not far from the bicycle casino in Bell Gardens, and had a pool. And I was always—he told me I was always welcome to stay there and swim in his pool. Yeah, at that point, I felt totally screwed by the poker gods. I didn't. It took me weeks and months, and maybe even years, to fully appreciate how much luck I had to have—good luck I had to have—in order to be at the final table, in order to get rivered out on a, you know, I just, he sucked out on me for a 2 million chip pot, and if I had won that pot, I would have, you know, I would have been in much, much dramatically better shape. So I do appreciate that my overall luck was pretty good that year.
You busted out in fifth place, winning almost $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
But you still had to go and watch the rest of the event so you could write about it.
Yeah.
Probably all you wanted to do was go upstairs and cry or something like that.
Or throw up.
How were you able to concentrate on the rest of the tournament?
It was my job, and at that point I owed Harper's an article. And so I just, you know, it was all new to me. You know, making it to the final tables, brand new to me. Getting rivered out of a 2 million chip pot, that was brand new to me. And I somehow figured out, I summoned the gumption to go and sit down next to Andy and a couple other writers and sat down and reported on the action. It was not the most fun I've ever had.
I'll bet. But not the most fun you ever had, but at the same time, it was the high point of your life. So,
And I didn't know it, but I was taking notes on what would become a very successful book. So as lucrative as finishing fifth in the tournament was, the book writing was quite a bit more lucrative. So it all worked out for me.
I've written several books, none of which have come close to $250,000 in being lucrative. So it's a tough business, and I congratulate you.
It is a very tough business, and there's so much luck involved. You know, poker was booming then when the book comes out in April of 2003, just as the World Poker Tour is starting to use whole card cameras, and in the fall and ESPN broadcasts the Moneymaker Final Table with whole card cameras revealing much more information. So the boom hit just as my book was coming out. So things fell into place.
But it also was a really well written book. I mean, that helps a lot too.
Yeah, it was a convergence. You know, I had never written nonfiction before, but all the narrative, the fictional narratives that I had written helped me write that book. But what made the book succeed was that it was covering a murder trial and a poker tournament, and it was all pretty dramatic. And if the book came out today, it's going to have a different, you know, now that poker's sort of plateaued in the United States, it was booming in the early years, you know, in the early aughts. And my book really, it just caught a wave, and it carried me a lot further than it would have 2 or 3 years earlier or later.
Now, you frequently use the terms good Jim and bad Jim to describe mm-hmm. different parts of your personality. Now, the former one, good Jim, does everything correctly, follows what Cloutier and Brunson say to do, and the second one just doesn't. So give us some examples.
Well, Jim is also a good Catholic boy. He doesn't go to strip clubs. He's a happily married father of four, and he does what he's supposed to do. When he gets a $2,000 advance, or a $4,000 advance, two of which are expenses, he spends it on things he's supposed to spend it. Bad Jim is more likely to gamble all that money on a long shot bet to win a seat in the main event. So those two guys are struggling scene by scene, moment by moment, to figure out what the next move is. And, you know, those are the two aspects of my personality, that both of which were in play as I was out in Vegas.
And those are probably in play for most of us, in a different way. But I certainly have a good Bob and a bad Bob part of me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I don't have any good Jim part. The good Jim also knew that you don't enter pots by calling, and yet you did that a lot. And
yeah. I didn't always follow the advice. Go ahead.
Now you're a much more experienced player. Now in tournaments, do you enter pots by calling a lot less than you did then, or
much less? Back then, where the opening raise was four times big blind, 3.5 or 4 big blinds. Today it's 2 or 2.5. The poker world is very, very different now. So, but when you played smaller poker tournaments, half the people had almost no experience playing. The number, the percentage of people who knew how to play No Limit Hold'em reasonably well was much lower than it is today. Poker tournaments now, almost everybody has watched it on TV, they've read the books, and the game has been around another 15 or 20 years. So that, at least I'm not nearly good enough to dominate a table or a tournament unless I know what to do if I get good cards, and I know how to stay out of trouble, and I know how to play a short stack, because it's, you know, it's those things have been laid out fairly clearly by a wide variety of writers, and Lee Nelson among them. And so I'm one of these hundreds and hundreds of, or even thousands of players who knows basic strategy, probably even more than thousands. It's probably 50,000 people who know how to play decent No Limit Hold'em.
Do you still come out every year for the World Series?
Oh, yeah. Haven't missed it. Have my ticket already. I teach a summer course that ends on June 16th, and on the evening of June 16th, I'm on a plane from O'Hare to Vegas. And then I stay until my bankroll is gone. I've stayed out there as briefly as a week, and I've also been out there for 7 weeks. So my poker year is built around my trip to the Rio, and I do not plan on missing it until I can't get on an airplane or sit up straight at a poker table.
I request that you give me a call when you come out. I would love to share a meal or a drink. I'm going to have to pass on going to the strip club. My own wife has issues there that I don't want to deal with. But
plus, Bad Jim is too old to go to strip clubs, so we'll just go out and have a nice dinner.
Good. We'll put on our diapers and just walk around with our cane. Yeah, that sounds like a great plan. Okay. Now, I found it interesting that the Murphy-Tavish trial was going on simultaneously with the main event, and you got to speak somewhat regularly with Becky Bainan, who was Ted Binion's older sister, also the owner of the Horseshoe and hostess of the tournament. It strikes me as an artistic invention devised by a novelist. It's not totally believable, but just does it to make the story more interesting, but it was the facts.
Right. That's why the book did so much better than my four previous books, which were novels. The sequence of events was so startling. I play in the World Series. I win a seat. I finish fifth on Thursday afternoon. Friday morning, I'm in jail for the reading of the verdict with the family of the victim. I had, over the course of my week in Vegas, I had interviewed Becky and Nick and her son Benny. So I had gotten to know the family pretty well. So that they invited me to hear the reading of the verdict of this, you know, this young couple was declared by a jury to have been guilty of first degree murder. And so that was, and that was on Friday morning. So that sequence was, if you put that in a novel, people would laugh you out of the building. It's just too much stranger than fiction.
In the 17 years since this tournament, you've been back to World Series every year, and you've actually moneyed many times, although mostly hold'em events of various sorts, but also Pot Limit Omaha and Seven Card Stud. Do you have a favorite game?
Yeah, I think I have a final table in Stud and Omaha. I've done, you know, for an aspired amateur, I've done reasonably well. I'm in the black in terms of my overall results. Most people aren't, so I consider myself to have done fairly well in World Series of Poker and related events since the year 2000. It's what I do. You know, I don't go on ski trips. I don't golf anymore. You know, I just play poker. I teach and I write and I play poker.
Which of those games is your favorite?
I'm probably better at No Limit Hold'em. My second favorite is Pot Limit Omaha. I can do reasonably well at horse, although as I get older and my short-term memory gets worse and worse, the stud games, you can get seriously overmatched by people who have photographic memories. Hold'em and Omaha, you don't have to remember folded cards. So I probably will play fewer and fewer horse events and stick pretty much to the Omaha and Hold'em events. As a matter of fact, I know that I will.
For our listeners who aren't aware what Omaha is, it's basically Hold'em, but you start with four cards instead of two.
And effectively giving you six hands, two-card hands.
Your title of Positively Fifth Street. I kept reading the book, trying to figure out where that title came in, and I didn't find it referenced anywhere. So what's the significance of the title Positively Fifth Street?
Well, I think the greatest American songwriter, maybe the greatest artist in any format, is Bob Dylan. And his song Positively Fourth Street is one of my favorites. Fifth Street, or the river in Hold'em, is the most important card. It's the card that got me knocked out or crippled by Hassan. So I just took the Dylan title and changed it from fourth to fifth.
Uh-huh. If I were more up on Dylan music, I would have known that. But I wasn't, so I didn't.
Well, now we all know.
All right.
Shame on you, Bob. That's the music of our generation.
Well, we're going to take a brief stop for commercials here. And when we come back, I want to share my personal recollection of that World Series, which has nothing to do with Jim McManus, and also talk to the professor about a book that's coming out later this year with a collection of gambling writers. And I want to talk to him about that.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. From now until May 25th, Monday through Thursday, you may play the $500,000 Swipe, Spin, and Win game. Play 300 points between 3 a.m. and 11 p.m. Spin the wheel at the kiosk to get your prize. Prizes include free play, cash, resort gift card, and food coupons. On Monday, Memorial Day, May 29th, there will be 2x points for video poker and bigger multipliers on reels, midnight to midnight, no limits, no machines excluded. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is 100 Play with Quick Quads. This game is featured so often as a game of the week, I've spoken about it frequently, so I'm going to pick another VideoPoker.com game that I don't get to talk about so often. The game I've chosen is Double Super Times Pay. Double Super Times Pay is a 7 coins per line game, and you can randomly get multipliers on the deal and or on the draw. The multipliers range between 1x and 10x, and they are additive, not multiplicative. That is, if you get 3x on the deal and 4x on the draw, you end up with a 7x multiplier, not a 12x multiplier. The game adds very close to a 0.5% to the game, which can be played with no strategy variations whatsoever. So as an example, 8-5 bonus normally returns 99.17%. The double super times pay version of the game returns 99.67%. The variance of this game goes way up, because the biggest jackpot is a dealt royal, which is one time in 650,000 hands, and while that is happening simultaneously, you have to get multipliers on both the deal and the draw. When that happens, both of those multipliers turn into 10x, so the sum of the multipliers is 20x. So a dollar 10 play, dealt royal, turns into an $800,000 monster. While this is very, very rare, the size of it is so big that it has a strong influence on the variance.
Okay, we're back. At the time of that World Series, the only player I knew was Chris Ferguson. He and I were both dancers. Swing dance.
Ballroom, right?
Well, yeah, his was more... We're both into swing dancing. His was more in the ballroom range, and mine was more a country western. But the two disciplines came together, and we had been introduced by a mutual partner a woman named Carol who danced with both of us, and we were the only two gambling people she knew. And so she hooked us up together, so we all had a lunch somewhere. At the time, this was several years earlier, and I had a very, very small bankroll. And Chris was talking about camouflage and playing blackjack. So he would say he would frequently go and take out a $1,000 marker at the craps table and splash around the money, and if he lost it, no big deal. It was just a 1.4%. Less when you consider the odds, and that would convince the pit that he was a gambler and not a card counter. At the time, I had a very small bankroll, within a few $1,000s, and the idea of taking a $1,000 marker at a craps table was just so alien to me. Now his technique seems to make a lot of sense, but at the time, I couldn't appreciate it. I was just too much of a low roller. But when I heard he was doing well in the tournament, I was rooting for him. I guess that makes me rooting against you, but I didn't. But Jim McManus was not a real person to me at that time.
Right. And Chris understands gambling and game theory probably as well as anybody alive, especially since he has a PhD in computer science and artificial intelligence. He knows the math of these games. He figures it out quick, and he camouflages his expertise at the blackjack table really well. He also does extremely well playing video poker. At least I haven't talked to him in a few years, but when I knew him, he played high stakes video poker, and the comps alone would cover, suites of, he did very, very well with his results and as well as the comps that he got for playing so high.
Yes, the comps on video poker 20 years ago were so much better than you could get from any kind of table games, and also so much better than you can get today. But the comps on video poker were very, very good back then.
Everybody knows that Phil Ivey is a great advantage player, but Chris could go into a casino and figure out where he had an edge, and he could exploit it quite brilliantly.
Yes.
So there's a new book coming out later this year that's a collection of writings by a number of gambling writers, yourself included, and Al Alvarez, who we mentioned earlier. Can you tell us a little more about that and when it'll be out?
It's called He Played for His Wife and Other Stories, and it's a collection of fiction written specifically for this anthology about poker. The stories involve poker, but they're also about the rest of life and the way poker fits into it. My contribution is about the last hand a poker player ever plays. Number of wonderful British writers, Jennifer Tilley, Barney Boatman, and Barney Boatman's going to have a story in it. Tony Holden, who is the editor. The other editor is Natalie Galustian, a London literary agent and gambling book collector. If you're ever in London, go to her shop, Natalie Galustian Books in Cecil Court. She's got every copy of, very high percentage of all the great gambling books for sale in her shop, some of them going back into the 1700s. And those two have put together this anthology, and it's coming out, I think, October 20th in London and in England and the United States. We should talk about it on the show.
Well, somehow you're going to get us a copy of either the books or the proof, and we're going to read it, and we're going to have you back on to talk about it.
I really look forward to it, and we should have the galley sometime. Middle of the summer.
Very good. That sounds like fun, and you'll talk mostly about yours, of course, but the other writers, we'll talk about those too, because
sure,
those are some pretty impressive names that you came up with.
I look forward to that, and I can give you a brief preview. My story is narrated by a character named Jim McManus, who is, even though it's fiction, it's narrated by the guy who wrote Positively Fifth Street. It's a fictionalized version of the last poker hand he ever plays.
Is it Good Jim or Bad Jim who wrote this?
It's Good Jim.
All right. That sounds worth waiting for. Thank you, Jim McManus. This has been a pleasure. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody.